You think about the analyst reverie. So that is to say, you're in a session and something is happening and patient is telling you something and your mind starts to drift and images come to your mind. Say a particular image or an idea, it just sticks and it won't let go. It may well be, and usually it is, that there's something happening with the patient they cannot tell you because they don't know. But it's stirring up something in you that's resonating. And I mean, it is our job. And an image will come out of that. And that allows us to find a register, a meaningful register in which to speak to the patient.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast was created in order to share with our colleagues and the community at large the many activities that psychoanalysts are involved in around the world that go beyond their individual clinical work in their consulting rooms. We have conversations with psychoanalysts who work with medically ill patients, who work in refugee centers, who work in community mental health centers, who work with police departments, with the United Nations, with business leaders, analysts who teach undergraduates, who work in prisons. There's a whole variety of quite remarkable work that analysts are bringing to various venues around the world. When COVID struck us all, we shifted our attention and we began meeting with analysts and talking with analysts again around the world to learn firsthand how they were dealing with this crisis and with the sudden shift to online treatment. And we've learned that different cultures, analytic cultures and political cultures, entail both similarities and differences among each other in how we're all facing this crisis. As part of that effort, we also began speaking with some of the elders in our field. And by elders, I mean those who've been practicing analysis for 40 to 50 years. And we ask them to reflect on this quite unique period of history and to also share their vision of our profession and how it's evolved for them over their many decades. In addition, psychoanalysis has always had a point of view about the societies in which we live. And we've been discussing with clinicians and psychoanalytic researchers on this new wave of othernesses that has been almost virus-like in wrapping the world, where groups of people from all vantage points are being treated as cold others. And there's something about our common humanity that is more and more difficult for us to hold on to. And analysts have a great deal to say about that, and we've been discussing that with colleagues, again, from around the world. And we're going to continue focusing on these three areas: work that analysts do off the couch, reflections on what COVID is doing to all of us, and hopefully what it will be like for us as we leave COVID hopefully behind, and also the reflections that we analysts have on the societies in which we live. I hope you enjoy these conversations. Please feel free to comment on our website, ipaoffthecouch.org. And thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Professor Marcia Hewitt. Professor Hewitt is a psychoanalyst in private practice in Toronto, Canada. She is also a professor of religion in the Department for the Study of Religion in the University of Toronto and Trinity College in Toronto. Professor Hewitt's books include From Theology to Social Theory, Juan Luis Segundo and the Theology of Liberation, Critical Theory of Religion, a Feminist Analysis, and Freud on Religion, which, by the way, is probably the most in-depth study of Freud's relationship to religion that I've read. Her most recent book is Legacies of the Occult, Psychoanalysis, Religion, and Unconscious Communication. And it is this aspect of unconscious communication that we take up in some detail in our conversation today. We discuss the early history in psychoanalysis and Freud's relationship to unconscious communication and telepathy and what he called thought transference. We take up what it means to be in relation with an analysand and to have the experience where you're daydreaming about something, you're in reverie, and moments later you hear almost the same thoughts and images from the patient. What happens that makes that happen? What does it mean, if anything? How it relates to the transference? How it may be related to the common phenomena that she reports, which is that trauma experiences often encourage these kinds of, quote, thought transference phenomena, what that means. And what we learned from Dr. Hewitt is the importance of always maintaining an open-minded curiosity, neither naivete nor cynicism, but an open-minded psychoanalytic curiosity about what is the meaning of the phenomena that I'm encountering. It's a lesson, I think, that applies to unconscious communication and so much else that we encounter in the clinical setting. With pleasure, here is my conversation with Professor Hewitt. Marcia, welcome to the podcast. It's nice to have an opportunity to speak with you again. Marcia, this topic of unconscious communication, also called thought transference, is both challenging and invigorating. It's challenging, of course, because it's so easily confused and contaminated by the world of fortune tellers and seances and clairvoyances. And the field has been concerned from the origins about contaminating, if you will, the true value and science of psychoanalysis with the world of entertainment and trickery. Freud was very concerned about that, of course, while he never lost interest in telepathy, and we'll talk a bit about that. When asked about it, he said, you know, my interest in telepathy is like my Judaism and my cigar smoking. They're sort of just personal aspects of myself. Now, of course, we today may have a different point of view about the division he was trying to make between the personal and the professional, but nevertheless, that's how he held it. So that's how it's challenging, but it's invigorating, potentially, because it invites us to dive more deeply into the study of the intimate psychoanalytic dyad. What is it that happens in that intense transference experience between two human beings closely involved over long periods of time? What's the fullness of that? So it offers the possibility to really discover more nuance to our work. And I must say that having read your two books on the subject, I find that you walk a very fine and thoughtful line between these challenges. You are committed to letting the data take us where it takes us, which is the truth of a scientist or the truth of a psychoanalyst, without at all being naive and without mistaking subjective truths for objective truths. And I have to both admire you and appreciate your courageousness, because you've gone where practically no one else has gone in our field. And to begin us off, I'm going to quote two of our grandparents. Now, when speaking about something as tricky as unconscious communication, it's always good to start by quoting Freud. And in 1915, he said about thought transference, quote, "Thought transference is where a verbal message gets transformed into a wave or ray of quite unknown nature, and then on reception is reconverted into material terms," close quote. He just took that as a given, that that's what it was. In 1926, Helena Deutsch wrote a paper called "The Occult Processes Occurring During Psychoanalysis," and she wrote, "During psychoanalysis, the psychic content between analyst and analysand is so intimate, and the psychic processes which unfold themselves in that situation are so manifold, that the analytic situation may well include all the conditions that facilitate the occurrence of occult phenomena. These effects are probably connected with transference and seem to indicate the existence of an essential relationship between analytic intuition and the telepathic process. Close quote. That's the key part of that quote that strikes me, the essential relationship between analytic intuition and the telepathic process. Marsha, help us out here. Tell us about this unconscious communication world that you've been investigating and immersing yourself in.
It's complex and it's huge. So all I think I can do, and the answer won't be adequate, but I can just tell you the way I think of it. And I can just, I want to mention a few things that you just said in your opening remarks. So the first quotation from Freud, as I understand that, he was being pressed at the time by Ernst Jones about it. Jones was quite frustrated with Freud. He said quite openly in his biography of Freud that he couldn't understand how a mind so rational, so clear, could possibly entertain seriously this phenomenon of unconscious communication. And I think Freud was just frustrated at that moment, and that is how he responded. And there's a lot of truth to that response. There's a lot of things we don't know. But one of the ways, and having, you know, read Freud and read, you know, quite a bit of the literature, I'm also a scholar in the study of religion as well. So those are two disciplines that go together for me. In terms of Freud, the only way to adequately understand what he meant by what is known in English popularly as telepathy has to be located in the entirety of his theory. Like the books, like the writings on religion and culture, these can't be hived off into the cultural books that are somehow applied psychoanalysis. And similarly, what Freud says about telepathy also can't be really adequately understood if it's not located in the context of psychoanalytic theory as he conceived of it. The German is Gedankenübertragung, which means thought transference, and transference is the key. His theory of transference, his theories of the unconscious, these are key to understanding how he approached the phenomenon. As early as the so-called Papers on Technique, he talks about the drift of the unconscious between the analyst and the analysand. He talks about the need for the analyst to be open, like a kind of a receiver or a telephone receiver, to the unconscious of the analysand. It's true what you said. This is very true, that he was writing in a time where he was very much battling against a number of forces, the emergence of experimental psychology in the late 19th and early 20th century, lab-based type psychology. It was also a time when spiritualism was extremely popular on both sides of the Atlantic. And as part of that, there was a lot of, you know, charlatans and tricksters and, mm-hmm. you know, performance and, you know, entertainment halls and so on. He didn't want psychoanalysis to be associated with any of that. At the same time, psychoanalysis, I mean, its work is to explore and try to understand the irrational or the non-rational. The unconscious is not something you can see. You infer it. You know, you won't find it if you do an autopsy on somebody. It's an inference, but it's a clinical inference. It's a clinically rooted inference. Anyway, there was a lot of things that he was worried about. He was really worried about psychoanalysis, particularly because of the concept of the unconscious getting somehow absorbed by spiritualism. So there was a number, he had a number of concerns about that. He admitted that he didn't know the, let's call it the mechanics of it. Like, how does that work? What does it mean when, you know, and it doesn't have to be in a clinical situation. You're thinking of a friend of yours you haven't seen in a long time. You're thinking for days about them and they call. You know, Jung had one way of dealing with it, synchronicity. Freud didn't. Freud understood that, but he didn't know exactly how it worked. So how did he think about it? And how does psychoanalysis think about it ever since? And another word I want to say just, you know, at the outset, the term occult is both very innocent and very unfortunate. Occult has come to mean the kind of dustbin of intellectual detritus. You know, what orthodox or mainstream or, I don't know, commonly accepted epistemological frameworks and categories and concepts and so on, what they reject as being not, you can't include it, you can't do anything with it, it's non-rational, it's whatever, has tended, you know, really from the days of Newton, has tended to be, you know, cast off to the dustbin of Western intellectual history. All occult means is hidden. That's all it means. It means you can see the effect of something, like an apple falling from a tree, but you can't see the force of gravity. You infer it. You know it's there. It's that sort of thing. So that's another thing I want to say. The term occult has got so it's associated with so much. It is so loaded in so many unfortunate ways.
Even as you describe the true meaning of it, of being hidden.
Yeah.
Of course, it's true. And in medicine, you know, the phrase, the occult bleed, that it's hidden. You don't know where it's from. And yet, outside of that context, occult, like you say, does share this sort of mysterious and disdainful weirdness.
Yeah, it does. It's it gets sort of bound up with what people call, you know, kind of new age spirituality. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The term new age itself, that is a serious object of study. That's not something to, you know, that's, so I'm saying all of this because the way Freud approached the phenomenon of thought transference and the way I approach it and the way those, you know, thinkers that are my interlocutors approach it, we think about it psychoanalytically. So if somebody has a dream and the dream is, you know, maybe a premonition or something, psychoanalysis does not get caught up with the details. Oh my goodness, you had a dream that you met your Aunt Harriet and she was wearing a purple dress and lo and behold, on a Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock, you know, but we don't do that. Some people do. Some people do. But the way I try to think about it is, what is this telling me about the relationship? And one of the things the literature tells us, not only in psychoanalysis, but elsewhere, because telepathy means feeling at a distance. So what it tells us is that there's something about the affective, emotional intensity of a relationship that's very important here. Thought transference, like the kind I said earlier, somebody calls you, you've been thinking about, and so mm-hmm. on. These things occur in the context of a close, intimate, intense relationship. It can be positive, it can be negative, it, you know, it can be someone you haven't seen in years, but you were once close to, right? And so when I confront these kinds of things, and my colleagues too, you know, people, psychoanalysts are much more relaxed these days about talking about this. But even there, you know, there's almost as many approaches and interpretations of thought transference among psychoanalysts today as there are, you know, cases or examples of it. But I look at it in terms of, okay, what is this telling me about the relationship? And that's the way Freud did it. What is happening between us that's going on unconsciously outside of my awareness that I must be attentive to? Now, as for the rest of it, the accuracy, say, of a dream or whatever, I just employ the term that many people in the study of religion rely on. Not everybody, but many, and that's bracketing. It's from Husserl. It's bracketing. I bracket the issue, the question of, let's just call it, the ontological independent reality of whatever the phenomenon is. I bracket that and I look at subjective experience, right? Now, another point as to why I think this is important. So if you think about, now you asked about, you know, other thinkers. If you think about people like Bion, or you think about particularly someone like Thomas Ogden, whose work I admire very much, you think about the analyst's reverie. So that is to say, you're in a session and something is happening and patient is telling you something and your mind starts to drift and images come to your mind. Say a particular image or an idea, it just sticks and it won't let go.
Sure.
It may well be, and usually it is, that there's something happening with the patient they cannot tell you because they don't know. But it's stirring up something in you that's resonating. And, I mean, it is our job. And an image will come out of that. And that allows us to find a register, a meaningful register, in which to speak to the patient. Bion called that the emotional truth. And so that's what I mean. So when you think about the unconscious, and so much of this work is about unconscious relationships, that, you know, the drift, I think it's a beautiful phrase, the drift of the unconscious, these little things will pop up, these images. And our job is to try to help the patient put into words, symbolize, put into words, experience that has as yet resisted or has not been able to come into language and has not been able to be reflected upon. Now, when you think about that, that could lend itself, if someone was so inclined, to very easily to kind of, let's just say, mystical or spiritual interpretations, because we deal with the unseen. We deal with the unseen. That's what we do. And that's what the unconscious is about. Freud was exquisitely sensitive to that. And he was exquisitely sensitive to the fact that the line or the permeability between psychoanalysis as he understood it and, you know, this other interpretation, which he thoroughly rejected, was quite fluid.
Let me ask you, with that example of the reverie of our letting the experience of being with this person wash over us and coming up with images that match something meaningful in the patient's mind that they either know about or don't know about. I think all analysts would say that that's something they're familiar with, if not almost commonplace.
Yeah.
But the question is that what you mean by unconscious communication? Because that seems different than you had a dream of a friend and they called you and you assume that those two events are related.
It's not different. There are different dimensions, I think, of a common phenomenon, some of which we understand and accept and some of which we don't. Right? So that's why I bracket the piece that I can't explain and nobody can. And Freud said the same thing. He said, someday science will be able to tell us. Science will be able to tell us how this actually works, like we understand how, a transatlantic call works. Now we know how that works. Now we know about electricity. Now we know about, you know, the internet. We know how these things work. But in his day, and now, and still now, we don't know how it works between people. So that piece of it that is okay, the details of the dream or the thought or whatever, I leave that, and I tell you why. First of all, It would just take you down a rabbit hole because there's nothing you can't explain it, and I'm pretty comfortable with that. But second of all, it takes you away from the patient. You know, if I'm with a patient and the patient tells me something, as people do, as they do, they tell me, you know, very, very, what would be, you know, regarded commonly as very strange kinds of experiences, clairvoyance, you know, premonitions, whatever. As I try to stay very close to the patient, I don't let my attention get diverted to those aspects of it, like a sparkly object.
Sure.
I don't. Mm. I really try to. Now, you said earlier, you said, well, this is something most analysts would take for granted. I don't know that they do, actually. I don't know that they do. I mean, I've had many conversations with analysts and study groups and whatever, who actually would say that for the analyst to entertain a reverie, for the analyst to let a reverie that seems on the surface unconnected to what's going on between the patient and the analyst, like, you know, suddenly you start, or something comes to mind, you got to pick your child up from daycare at four like that, that's somehow unprofessional, or that somehow some, you know, shortchanging the patient. Quite a few people think that way. I don't.
We hang in different circles.
Well, but...
Let me ask you a question, but just to push the point further a little bit.
One thought here.
Yes.
That is why I think, you know, there's different ways of interpreting that, but that is why I am very firm about locating thinking about this phenomena within psychoanalytic theory and using psychoanalytic concepts like transference, like projective identification and counter-identification, or trans-identification, rather. That's why I do that, because that's what we're talking about, I think. Sorry,
No. Just to draw an important line in my mind, and help me understand it. If there's more to understand about it, that is, I'm thinking of an example of some time ago. I'm sitting with a patient, and what I get in my mind is the image of a young woman I know, who at the time was eagerly looking for a job. And just like you described with the reverie, it just popped into my head. And I wouldn't have even noticed that it was there, except a minute or two later, the patient, who was not talking about anything manifestly related to that, starts describing her encounter with somebody who was applying to her for a job and her various feelings about their needs for the job, etc. And it occurred to me that it was word for word what came to my mind and then came in her mind. Now, I guess the easy answer is that we were both in touch with something latent going on, and it occurred to us in the various ways it occurred to us. But when I spoke to colleagues about this, they said, and I asked, does that kind of thing happen to you? They said, oh, yeah, sure. I said, well, as you said, how do you understand that? And they came up with, you know, Freud's line, the one I mentioned, as if that explains it, which of course it doesn't. And they were comfortable both acknowledging that they had that experience and that they were going to relegate it to, you know, Freud's comment and just let it go. It was just one of these things that they have. So that's, to me, category one. A different category is, in your book and in your presentation, you've presented material of a patient who had no knowledge of your being away on a weekend, and yet had a dream upon your return describing almost exactly the place you went. And that seems to me to be different than my sitting in a shared intimate space with a patient and our both coming up with our own versions of need. Tell me how you see it otherwise.
Well, I don't know that I do see it otherwise, but there's more to it, right? I mean, when a person, you know, one of your colleagues says to you, as mine do too, yeah, this kind of thing happens all the time, I don't stop there. I keep thinking. You know, there was an interview with Barbara Ehrenreich in the New York Times several years ago, and where she said, if you don't understand something, keep thinking. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to keep thinking.
Sure.
And so in this particular case, this was somebody that I was seeing in a four times a week analysis already for about 4 years. So this was a pretty close relationship. This was a pretty intensely close relationship. And, you know, there was in the history of the patient a fair amount of trauma over the course of her life. We were very attuned to each other. I liked her very, very much. And so there was that degree of, of a very strong connection. When she told me that dream, my reaction at the time, I didn't say anything. I was shocked. I was really shocked. I didn't know what was going on. But I realized fairly quickly that the shock was around the astonishing accuracy of the description of where I was. I cannot explain that. And I don't really care about that. What I cared about was she was showing me something that had taken place between us that I had not been aware of until she had that dream. And I explain all that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So when I try to think about a clinical example like that, that I go into great detail in the book, then I start to look at what psychoanalytic interlocutors can I look to help me with this. There are some, especially today, who will get really interested in how this proves that, I don't know, this proves that telepathy, shows us, I don't know, something about the interconnected nature of the universe. And that may well be. But I don't do that. I look at people like, for example, Hans Lowald. Now, Hans Lowald's understanding of the unconscious, for example, and of what he calls, the psychic matrix, and the way in which he locates the subjectivities of the mother and the infant and so on. That to me is the kind of thinking that I find lends itself to a much richer and deeper theoretical and clinical thinking about these phenomena. So when people use the term intersubjectivity, that can mean a lot of things. What it does not mean for me is I the subject, you the object, I say mine, you say yours. Mm-hmm. We come to an agreement or not. But we are still fairly discreetly bounded separately from each other. There is truth to that, but there's also something else as well. There's a way in which subject and object mutually constitute each other. And that's not a new insight, certainly, to psychoanalysis. That's also, an insight that comes from continental philosophy. I mean, that's not a new idea. But when I think about that, and then I think about the psychic matrix that Lowald uses, and it's interesting, matrix of the matrix, the movies, and so on. But that's that kind of thinking I find very helpful. But does it take us to the end? Does it drain this phenomenon of all mystery? No, it doesn't. It can't.
Let me return to that example of the patient having the dream. I guess I'll plead I'm susceptible to shiny objects. It is a very shiny object when a patient is able to describe to the colors of the hotel you were staying at in her dream. Mm-hmm. But you say it's about the relationship, and no doubt. You, if I may, in describing her, you said twice and slowly, you said, and I liked her very much, mm-hmm. and you repeated it, which I took to be a euphemism that you loved her. You needn't confirm or disconfirm, and just allow me for the moment, mm-hmm. that you loved her. And if your focus is then on the relationship and the meaning of the dream, is it her way of letting you and maybe her know in disguise that she loves you, and that your whereabouts on a weekend are of great importance to her as part of her love of you. And that's how one can approach it psychoanalytically.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, I'm not shy about the concept of psychoanalytic love. Neither was Freud and neither was Lowell.
Okay.
I accept that. I accept that. You have to, if you love psychoanalysis, then you obviously love the people that you are working with in a very particular sort of way, very specific, as you well know. So this is very interesting. When I presented this case in a few different, at a few different conferences, and I presented it a couple of years ago, and a very senior analyst from New York, who was on the panel that I was on, made a comment that really stuck with me. I was focusing on, but I mentioned this in the book, I was focusing on very much, how she was able to find me. But what he pointed out was, how interesting it was that I took her with me. You see, it really struck me. Now, I think what happened with her, it was not, and I say this in the book, it was not so much her going along with me, but as we know, with people who have been subjected to sustained trauma in early life, we know that they can have a very highly developed, let's just say, sense of vigilance or hypervigilance, and read the tiniest cues and shifts in others' attention and so on. We know this. This is not news. I think this was, as I say in the book, I was going somewhere very special, California, which I love. I was going out to California, and I was in a state of kind of, I guess I'd call it quiet excitement and anticipation for some weeks before I went. Now, I wasn't, I didn't have travel brochures all over my office or anything like that. I wasn't taking calls, nothing at all like that. I wasn't really aware of it myself. As far as I knew, in my work, I was as focused as always, and I'm sure I was. But there was something that was captivating my attention, my excitement. There was something that I was really wanting, and it wasn't her. And I think she picked that up. I think she picked up nothing, I don't think, from the session, but of course it had to be in there. Something, who's the writer? One analytic writer talks about, thinks about the kind of the Oedipal configuration as, it can include many things. It can be symbolic of many things. And one of the things the analyst loves is her work. The analyst, hopefully, loves psychoanalysis. And so she has her books, she has her conferences, she has her colleagues. She has a world that does not include the patient, that the patient cannot be a part of, right? And I think, if I think of it that way, which is to say, basically, you're very special to me, but not that special. You have to share me. There are other things that are related to what we do, but that are much more, or they also take my attention. And I found that essay very helpful. I found that very, very helpful in thinking about what was going on with her. And I think she picked it up. And one of the things that that told me was, is that she was much closer to me. Yeah. In a new way than she had been previously. That's the way.
I hear you.
I read that.
I want to pick up on something you just mentioned. Among the many things I learned from your book was the importance of trauma in people who are capable, let's call it that, of this kind of communication. And I'm interested in why you think that is. And I reflected back on a number of experiences I've had. And my experience in working with people who've been traumatized is that, as you say, they are exquisitely attuned to gestures, to sounds, mm-hmm. to anything that catches their ear and eye. And of course, they have a trauma-derived narrative that they assign to it. Mm-hmm. And what has struck me about it and the challenges of working through that is that there may be 30 factors that go into the particular gesture that they've identified, but they're locked in on meaning one, which is, of course, their narrative, and it's usually something dangerous or deprecatory. And it's important and difficult to both be aware that what they're locating as the one item of meaning is both true and not true, because it's only, in fact, one of 30, and I need to be centered on all 30 to both give that their number one its due, but without being swamped by it and thinking that it's the only thing that it is, like they think. So it's a real tension-filled moment. But that seems to me to be different than unconscious communication. Or what do you think?
Well, again, all I can do with this, as with almost anything in life, really, is just think about it. I can't answer any of it. I can think about it. And so, you know, in this case, she wasn't wrong. There was something that I was very excited about that wasn't her. There was something that was taking me out of the country. Now, again, she didn't know that she couldn't have known that in a conscious way. But in previous years and working together, breaks, holiday breaks, vacations, and so on, filled her with tremendous anxiety that if I left, if I went away, something bad would happen to me, that she wouldn't see me again. When you talk about trauma, I mean, it's in much of the literature, much of the psychoanalytic and the neuropsychoanalytic literature as well. We find this observation repeatedly that there's something about the incredible investment of psychic energy in a narrow kind of area that has to stay there because it's too dangerous to invest one's psychic energy in exploring the world and being curious about the world, mm-hmm. because really you're focused on survival. You have to read the facial expressions, the subtle shifts, the cues in the abuser. You have to, so you can at least, you have a chance to run and hide, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, this you find this in many disciplines, this insight, you know, that comes up. So it may well be that, and I think it is, that people who have experienced this kind of thing over a sustained period, as they are forming and psychologically developing, they are able to develop this exquisite sensitivity to others, to the slightest shifts of attention and so on. So I think that is true, and I think it's helpful. Again, all of this to bring my, at least for me, my focus back to the patient, right?
Sure.
And what you were saying a minute ago about 30 things and only one is true or so on. I mean, Freud was very clear that in the most florid psychosis, and I know we're not talking about that here, but just to be clear, sure. There is always a kernel of truth. Mm-hmm. There's always a kernel of truth. And I take that very much to heart. So if someone says something to me, say, presents me to myself in a way that I can't recognize, I have to go and look for, however distorted it might be or painful, where's the kernel of truth? So in this case, my attention was not qualitatively focused on her in the same way as it usually was prior to my plans to go on this trip. I am not aware of that, but I think that was one of the messages she was telling me.
And as you make clear in the report of the patient, at times when you did announce vacations, you would often give her things of yours to take with you. And this could be an extension of that, that without your telling her, she even unknown to her likely took something of yours with you, which is your location.
Or as my colleague said, I took her with me, which really...
Right, right.
Well, I liked that. You know, I was at first I was startled when he said that, but I liked it. I liked it. I liked that idea.
Marcia, we could go on. There's so much I'd like to talk to you about, but I don't want to lose a moment to ask about you. This is unusual work. Being an analyst is unusual work, but in particular, being an analyst who is also a professor of religion, I don't know if there are others in our field, and that you bring them together in this interest in, well, the book title does use the word occult, Legacies of the Occult. What brings you to this?
Well, let me see. I've been teaching religion for decades and psychoanalysis also for decades. Human experience. My next project that I'm working on is I want to bring a psychoanalytic perspective to bear on spirit possession across cultural incidents of reports or ethnographic work on spirit possession. I'm very interested, as a psychoanalyst, I suppose, and as a scholar in the field of the study of religion, human beings relate to unseen worlds all the time. The unseen is a very important part of human experience. And I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the way in which people imagine that, the way in which they relate to that. With spirit possession, I've, you know, in no way do I think of this as something to be translated into diagnostic or pathologizing terms, for example. Sure. But there's different ways of relating. There's different forms of subjectivity. One of my colleagues has a wonderful way of putting it, an anthropologist, Michael Lambeck. He refers to it as cohabitation, a kind of a cohabiting of subjectivities. And you find this, you know, around the world. You find in North America, there's a long history in the U.S., as you well know, of spiritualism, but also in religious contexts, in Protestant religious contexts, of people talking to the dead, communicating to the dead, communicating with the dead, right? So the dead are, now, I want to be very clear here. I am not saying that there is a supernatural realm or heaven where souls go or anything. I am not saying that, and I couldn't say that because I don't know, nobody knows. I'm interested in the ways in which human beings negotiate their worlds. And their worlds are not just our worlds, are not just confined to, you know, getting up in the morning and going to work when that was possible before, but you know, our ancestors, our family members, you know, so this is global. This is a human phenomenon. And it's not about crazy. It's about learning about and being so interested in human minds and the way we conceive of our worlds and the way we negotiate the contents of our minds with each other, right? I mean, Freud, you know, when Freud talked about the belief in, you know, the afterlife, you know, he was very clear. So if you have a dream about a dead friend or relative, and that person comes to you in a dream, the Bible is full of those accounts, for example, and you have that. Well, I mean, of course, that person's not dead. Of course, that person exists somewhere in your mind. Now, he didn't attribute to it any kind of supernatural explanation or whatever, but he acknowledged it. It's true. And I think it's something for us to be very curious about. You know, the idea that the world is disenchanted and that the only and superior form of knowledge and reason is kind of, you know, cold calculation,
sure,
and instrumentality, I think is, I think that's insane.
Actually. Sure. That's why the Enlightenment had to go through a few iterations. Marcia, you are courageous in your interest in these areas, and you resist anyone who will limit who you are and how you think to cartoon or caricatures. You keep your eye psychoanalytic no matter what the phenomena is that you're observing, and it's a real gift to our field. And I'd like to close us by reading a couple of sentences from your book, and it's your concluding thoughts. And this is, you write, "As scholars of psychoanalysis and the study of religion, it is imperative that we engage the most inconvenient and unsettling challenges to our theoretical premises and critical frameworks with both intellectual rigor and generosity." And you have succeeded in doing that, Marcia. I'm grateful for knowing your work and knowing you. And I hope the listeners find your undaunted perspective of open-mindedness as refreshing and challenging as I do.
Well, thank you so much, Arvi.
Thanks for being on board here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.